Welcome to KPTZ's Nature Now, a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now for the middle of January. I'm Kate Dwyer, here today with wildlife biologist Daryl Smith. Our main subject will be sea wolves. Never heard of such a thing? Well, stay tuned then. But first, today's mystery sound. We have a lot of nature observations today, most of them from Daryl, but a very interesting one was sent in from Wendy Feltham, who went on a Natural History Society walk along Anderson Lake recently with Cheryl Lowell. She pointed out winter twigs, and they came upon a phenomenon a couple of people have noticed recently. Beautiful icy crystal filaments on a log. They're called silky hair ice, and they grow on cold, wet logs. Carbon dioxide, made by fungi, pushes filaments of ice from the logs, and they look like shiny cotton candy. She included a photo with this, and it really is a beautiful formation.
Pretty stunning, isn't it?
Yeah.
I noticed almost the same thing on the street in front of our house the other day. It looked like snow. We've got some more things going on right now, Kate. Just about this time of the year, a lot of people don't know, young black bears, and grizzly bears for that matter, but black bears locally are being born in the dens. And mothers have gone into the dens primarily in late October, early November. And they are true hibernators, even though we've gone back and forth on that as scientists, whether to describe that or not. They are being born right now. Mothers and babies will emerge in April or whenever it starts to green up and there's enough food for them to come out.
How large are they when they're born?
Very small, about the size of kittens.
Wow.
Yep, people don't realize that. So.
Oh, I bet they're adorable.
Well, you know what? In fact, they really are. People like bears in general. So.
Right.
But also, this time of the year, there's a lot of owl activity.
Yes, so. Let's talk about that. I want to show you off. Good birders and biologists know how to call birds, particularly owls. So why don't you run through the signature calls for us of some of the local owls?
You just about can't go anywhere in the woods here and not be within earshot of an owl. First of all, owls hear very, very, very well, but they're also very vocal.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we're hearing barred owls and saw-whet owls, and we're hearing some screech owls and great horned owls.
Okay.
So barred owls make a call like this is called the two-note call, and it's
wonderful.
That drawn out is characteristic of the males or females. It's longer in the females and shorter in the males. And great horned owls will sound something like hoo 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 hoo.
The classic cartoon owl, you
classic
know,
hoo hoo call.
Yeah,
that's right.
Okay.
The female might have been first with a lower call, and the male second. I might have that wrong. Males are lower, females are higher, even though females are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And then the saw-whet owl is a very nocturnal owl, one of our most common.
Uh-huh.
But people don't see it because it's so nocturnal and so small.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hearing them down above the bluff. We live at Cape George in a large fir tree.
Right.
And they sound like this. They sound... It's called a toot call, and pygmy owls sound something like that, too.
All right. Well, that was Daryl himself with his very own voice making calls. But now we're going to listen to a tape you brought us. Why don't you describe what's going on in that tape, Daryl?
Just like the taxonomy, the DNA work I talked to you about, people are studying vocabularies of animals.
Mm-hmm.
We now know that barred owls, for example, have a vocabulary of 13 different phrases.
Wow.
And probably many more than that. So this one is actually a pair of owls doing what's called the gurgling call.
Hmm.
We think it's a sort of territorial defense call, but both male and female are participating.
Uh-huh.
And one time, Kate, along the Saddle River, I was out with friends, and just for a lark, I made a barred owl call, the who cooks for you call.
Right.
And immediately, two sets of owls descended overhead.
Oh,
and they did this call for about 15 minutes and scared the heck out of the friend that was with me. He had no idea what was going on.
You must have seemed like a wizard. You called the owls from the heavens.
Yeah. Well, maybe I am. Huh?
Yeah, maybe you are.
No, they're actually the wizards. So it's a distinctive call. We brought this call just to show you how different things are.
Okay. Thank you very much. Barred owls are very early, aren't they?
They're not as early as, in general, as great horned owls.
Okay.
These birds don't make their own nests, so that gives them a jump on nests that have been constructed by red-tailed hawks and eagles. So they get a jump on them.
If the owls take over an eagle's nest before the eagles are ready to nest, will the eagles come along and have a fight with them? Or
eagles can displace them, I think. Uh-huh. But great horned owls are... They're actually known worldwide as eagle owls. They're one of the eagle owls, the genus Bubo, along with snowy owls are now in the genus Bubo. So they're big owls, and they're pretty formidable. Right. So oftentimes, though, eagles will make alternate nests. They'll have alternate nests to go to.
Right.
It may or may not be a tussle.
Right. Now, what are the eagles up to now?
2 weeks ago, Lorna and I got a call from folks who had seen an eagle down in the forest. It was late in the day. We weren't actually able to find the eagle. But we talked to an eagle rehabilitator in the area, and she said they're getting a lot of eagles in who have been fighting with each other, or not so much fighting as jousting is a better term, for territories, new territories. And you'll see them, mated pairs will grasp talons and tumble towards the earth. But also, they do that to intruders as well, too. So that's happening. They're forming their territories, or actually consolidating their territories right now.
But not yet building the nest.
Well, we've actually seen some of them in the Cape George region. We've actually seen them carry branches.
Uh-huh. So the early guys are at it.
Yep.
So they don't necessarily, as is commonly thought, go to the same nest year after year. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Well, they usually have the same territory. They try to maintain the same territory. And we know that eagles have alternate nests that they'll use.
Right.
And who knows exactly why. There are a lot of reasons. Sometimes the nest platforms degrade, branches fall. Mm-hmm. There may be parasite issues with old nests.
Right.
Maybe they just want to change the scenery.
They want a waterfront view.
Well, they've all got a pretty good view.
Right. Well, to go to the other end of the bird scale, to go to a little tiny bird, the ruby-crowned kinglet, where did you see those recently?
Lauren and I were actually on the beach. Oftentimes in the late afternoon, the light is wonderful. The sun is down. Mm-hmm. And on those western-facing beaches, you have wonderful photography.
Sure.
It was interesting for us to find a ruby-crowned kinglet, very tiny bird, about half the weight of your thumb, foraging on the beach, and not a whole lot bigger than the sand grains.
Yeah. A little flock or just one?
A single one, but there were several in the area. Oftentimes, we notice they'll sort of gather together with chickadees.
Mixed species flock.
Yes, and sometimes juncos and finches,
Well, I saw the golden crowns in my garden. That was kind of nice. You say they just migrate up and down. They migrate up into the mountains. They don't go to South America or somewhere.
They're more lateral or local, as I think you said, in this crew, migrators. So that in the summer and spring, we will hear them in the montane forests.
Mm-hmm.
And they're hard to see oftentimes
because they're
up higher in the canopy.
Right. Well, that's great. Let's move on to our main subject today. And this came about because the National Geographic had a big interesting story in October last year. It's the October 15th issue, in case you want to look it up, is In Search of the Elusive Sea Wolves on Canada's West Coast. And the story reports on the work of the Raincoast Conservation Foundation, which spent 10 years studying a remote population of wolves on the outer coast of Vancouver Island. The article calls them sea wolves in the headline, but it also calls them coastal island wolves, as opposed to another kind of wolf that we'll talk about. Daryl's going to help us out with these kinds of wolves and very fascinating information about them. But let's start out with, what kind of work do you do? What's your job, Daryl?
Well, probably the reason I'm talking to you about wolves, Kate, is not just because I'm a wildlife biologist, but in 2012, my wife, Lorna, became the executive director, and many of you know this, folks around here, we've talked about this before, of what was then the Grizzly Bear Outreach Project. We were concerned with grizzly bear issues. So right now, we've taken on other issues and other responsibilities, and we're now known as Western Wildlife Outreach. So I'm a wildlife biologist and scientist and science advisor for the organization. We educate the public statewide about are large carnivores. And we have generally about, we're talking about carnivores that people consider dangerous,
mm-hmm.
not coyotes, which really aren't dangerous and are not considered
dangerous to humans,
but dangerous to humans, like grizzly bears, black bears, cougars, and gray wolves. So about the four biggest species we have in the state.
Lions and tigers and bears. Well,
that's right. Exactly. That's what we tell our grandkids, too. And they understand.
Not exactly lions, but well, you could say that.
Mountain
Some
lions,
people
actually.
Call them that. Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Well, let's go to the wolves now. As I see it, there's three wolf populations that we should discuss. Why don't you start with the more inland ones and move out to the coast and describe their differences for us?
Okay, so why is this topical here? Mostly it's because since 2008, when we first identified a wolf pack on Lookout Mountain near Twisp in Washington State, wolves have been coming in on their own four legs. They have not been introduced. Recently, in the scientific world, things have revolutionized because we have the ability to analyze genetic, the ability, the tools, now the economy to analyze the genetic makeup of animals and
You're
figure out how they're related to each
DNA
other.
DNA analysis.
The DNA, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it can be done economically and quickly, and it's been a wonderful tool.
It's revolutionizing some of the biological points of view, isn't it?
Oh, very much. Huge changes everywhere, including with wolves.
Mm-hmm.
So gray wolves in Washington State, the populations that came in the northeastern part of the state are primarily, we now know, related to – now, they're all the same species, by the way.
Yeah.
They're all related to wolves from the Rocky Mountains and from Montana and Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the wolves that have caused consternation with ranchers and so forth, and one of the more conservative parts of our population in the state. But through the same analysis, we're finding that the wolves in the Cascades – and there are, I think, three packs right now that are recognized. We're going to learn more about this when the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife reduces their wolf population analysis in March. And you can find that on our website.
All right.
They are related primarily to the coastal BC rainforest wolves.
Mm-hmm.
And the work you're talking about now results from observations by scientists and photographers
mm-hmm.
about wolves that seem to spend all of their time on the islands off the coast of British Columbia.
They're the ones they're calling coastal island wolves. But there's also the coastal inland wolves.
That's right.
That are,
so
they're along the coast, but they're not rock hoppers, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. So just to give you a better illustration here, all of these animals are the same species.
Mm-hmm.
Dogs are actually the same species as wolves, but they've diverged quite a bit. And you might consider that the Rocky Mountain wolves in the northeastern part of the state are kind of like the Swedes. The mainland wolves and the island wolves
uh-huh.
are sort of like Italians and the Spanish or something. They're much more closely related,
uh-huh.
but they do different things.
Right.
Sea wolves, which is a term we've also used for Vikings and
mm-hmm.
orcas and sea lions.
Football teams and
football
whatever.
Teams, exactly. seem to be totally dependent upon the beach, beachcombers.
Let me read this. It's from the article. They call them beachcombers. They chew barnacles, scarf up the gluey roe that herring lay on kelp. They feast on whales that wash up dead. They swim out into the ocean and clamber nimbly up onto rocks to pounce on basking seals. As much as 90% of these wolves' diet can come directly from the sea.
Astounding.
Yes, it is.
But what we do know is that they are drawn to the beach just as the first Americans were here in the Northwest.
It's a feast.
Yes, the feast. There's a lot of food. You just
mm-hmm.
if you know how to get it, you won't starve.
Right. And how do they differ from the coastal wolves then?
Well, the big thing you notice right off the bat is the way they get their food.
Okay.
And much less salmon, even though they're capable of eating salmon,
mm-hmm.
there aren't lots of big rivers on those islands like mm-hmm. there are in the mainland. So they eat less salmon. They eat barnacles, as you pointed out.
Mm-hmm.
They'll catch crabs. They found them fishing through kelp for snails and everything, and they seem to do a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're a little bit smaller.
Mm-hmm.
All of our coastal wolves, including the sea wolves,
mm-hmm.
are a little bit more colorful than the Rocky Mountain wolves.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot more red in their coat and a little bit smaller, like I said.
Yeah.
But one of the amazing things is, although we know that most carnivores will easily get into the water, including mountain lions,
mm-hmm.
these guys do it readily. They do it all the time.
Yeah, they're real swimmers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what about the diet of the inland coastal wolf, not the beachcomber wolf?
So that's interesting in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
The inland coastal wolf, they tend to be black-tailed deer specialists as opposed to elk specialists, which are the Rocky Mountain-type wolves.
Hmm.
But they eat more salmon. They can fish, evidently, as well as bears mm-hmm. and as efficiently. But salmon is toxic to canids.
Mm-hmm.
Wolves are canids. Your dog is a canid.
Right.
It's toxic because of a parasitic microorganism that's released by parasitic flukes.
Mm-hmm. That are like worms.
Yes, they're mm-hmm. very primitive worms.
Right.
That insist in salmon. When they release these microorganisms, rickettsia, for those of you who want to know, they inflame the gut, lethal about 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Only to canids.
They'll infect bears and they might give us a bellyache, but mm-hmm. they really are bad to canids.
So then how do these wolves get away with eating them?
So those of you who are physiologists and know a little bit about this know that there is a barrier, a blood-brain barrier, so that microorganisms don't readily go from your body to your brain. Wolves and even some coyotes, these animals have learned to eat only the brain of the salmon. There's a lot of nutrition in the brains. So it's a good way for us to track them, too.
Uh-huh.
Because if you see a lot of fish pulled out with the brain missing.
Yeah, that's wolf.
Yes. And we've even seen it. Somebody reported that to me here on the Stille in Washington State here this last year. So who knows?
To change topics a little bit, you also, because of your work, know about the distribution of wolves down here in Washington State. And you have models that predict when and where they're going to be. Can you tell us a little about that and how that's done?
In a paper just released just a few months ago, it was a collaboration between biologists and scientists at the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife, Washington State University, and I think there were a couple of investigators from the University of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
This was actually a modeling effort. And you have to remember that wolves were not introduced into the state, and they will not be introduced. It's one of the reasons is because they're doing this on their own.
Right.
So it did two things. It modeled habitat and it modeled movement patterns. We have some of the very best habitat in the Olympic Peninsula
mm-hmm.
and in the Olympic National Park. So they're saying by the year 2021.
Not very far off.
Just a little over five years.
Yeah.
We should have them fully distributed throughout the state, and they will do this entirely on their own.
Mm-hmm. Well, in another program, we might talk about what the impacts of that will be, both in natural history and politically, but not today.
Yeah, good. Again, we haven't had them for 70 years. We tell people, and this is the truth,
mm-hmm.
wolves are by far the least dangerous of all the large carnivores to humans.
What are the statistics on that?
We've been keeping track mm-hmm. in all of North America, and there are about 330 million of us now in North America.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes U.S., Canada, and Alaska. There have been three deaths in 160 years to wild wolves.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you extrapolate that to wolves that are kept in captivity, that get used to people, I think
right.
it's as many as 19.
Well, the issue is a lot more about cattle and other.
Yeah, and even that's overblown, as I think uh-huh. we're finding out solid science now. Good point.
Right. Well, you guys, a listening audience, if you'd like to know more about wolves, Daryl's organization's website is westernwildlife.org.
That's correct.
Yeah. And you can find out all kinds of stuff about our Washington State big animals.
Our website, we keep it up all the time. My wife especially is very good at putting out blog entries. And then we do the Facebook thing, the social uh-huh. media thing. So, and we get metrics back. During fall especially, we'll get lots of calls from students. But we try to keep the information up.
Now let's hear that mystery sound again. That sound is the alarm call of the peregrine falcon, a powerful and fast-flying raptor who hunts medium-sized birds, dropping down on them from high above in a spectacular stoop. They were virtually eradicated from North America by pesticide poisoning in the middle of the 20th century. After significant recovery efforts, falcons have made an incredible rebound and are now regularly seen in many large cities and coastal areas, including the cliffs along the Straits of Juan de Fuca here in Jefferson County.
In fact, Kate,
mm-hmm.
Ken Wilson
yeah?
had showed me a nesting pair just below Fort Worden on those cliffs.
Yeah, I've been there too. The popular annual Ways of the Whales Conference on Whidbey Island is coming up on January 23rd. For details, go to orca.net.
Nature Now is looking for another program producer. So if you think that you'd like to put together shows like this, please get in touch with Nature Now in care of KPTZ.
Yeah, it's fun. Well, that's it for this week's Nature Now. Repeats air on Thursdays at 5 and Saturdays at 11:30. Podcasts of recent Nature Now and other KPTZ programs are available at kptz.org. Thanks for listening.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is The Cold, The Dark, and The Silence, performed by Seawolf.
If you were to roll down your window, you'd find the wind, the ice, the trees that sway like skeletons outside. But when the cold, the dark, and the silence come, it's like a sudden rush of water through your heart and lungs. Please don't fight with me, and fold your arms like smell the sweetness of the soil and snow in the wind. So we're lost out here on the plains, my love. It's only wind and ice and trees that wave from above. But when the cold